You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. A brief program note, Neil Conan is back next Wednesday on Talk of the Nation, and he's broadcasting live from the Newseum, the new museum in Washington dedicated to the news. And if you're going to be in D.C. and you want free tickets to the audience, to be in the audience for that live broadcast of Talk of the Nation, send an email to tickets@npr.org. So tickets@npr.org. And you can sit in the audience. If you want to be in our audience today, our phone number 1-800-989-8255. Also, we're in Second Life, and for the first time, we're now in Second Life Teen Grid. If you're a teenager, only teenagers allowed in the Teen Grid. If you're a teenager, you want to hear the show in Second Life and ask questions with other avatars, you can head over to the I4U, E-Y-E, number 4U, I4U Alliance Island, and talk to other avatars and send us some questions. And for the rest of the hour, we're going to pick up on a story that you may have heard here just about a year ago. Last April, scientists announced the discovery of soft tissue preserved deep inside a fossilized 68-million-year-old T-Rex bone. That was a feat in itself, finding that soft tissue. And at that time, a paleontologist and a chemist joined forces to show that the tissue was the dinosaur's collagen protein. And now they've had a chance to study those dino proteins, searching for evolutionary links between dinosaurs and living animals. And their paper is out in today's issue of the journal Science. And joining us now to talk about dinosaurs and their closest living relatives, the birds, is one of the paper's authors. Mary Higby Schweitzer is an associate professor of marine, earth, and atmospheric science at NC State University, North Carolina State, and an associate curator of paleontology at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. And she joins us from her office at NC State. Welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
When we talked last year, you and your colleague, John and Sarah at Harvard, had shown that the soft tissue you recovered from that 68-million-year-old T-Rex was collagen, right?
That is what we did show, yes.
Mm-hmm. And since then, you've done a more analysis, and you worked out the similarities between dinosaur protein and some protein in living animals. Tell us what you found.
Well, the first the paper that we reported was basically producing the sequences, verifying the sequences by a couple of different methods that mass spectrometrists would be familiar with, and then doing a BLAST database search to see overall similarities. And it certainly did match. It was definite that it was collagen sequence, and then it did match with more closely with birds than anything else. Mm-hmm. So what we did in this paper that was just published yesterday in Science, we did a more rigorous analysis using a whole bunch of different algorithms, different ways that computers can model repeating evolutionary methodologies. And this showed that by four or five different types of analyses that our colleague Chris Organ performed, he was able to build phylogenetic trees, basically family trees of vertebrate history based upon these collagen sequences.
Mm-hmm. And
that's really cool.
Yeah, it's cool. Tell us what you found about the trees. How, so they're related, they have the same collagen types as birds, all kinds of birds?
Well, we are somewhat hampered by the fact that there aren't very many things in the commercial database that we can compare with, because it's overwhelmingly dominated by mammals, imagine that. And so you have a lot of chicken species, you have a lot of bird, you know, the birds that are in the databases available are usually the ones that we think are important, you know, like chicken.
Right.
But what John Sara was able to do is generate sequences from bone preparations of an ostrich, which, of course, is a bird, but is more primitive, and also generate sequences from an alligator, which is the other closest living relative to dinosaurs. And by adding these two taxa to the phylogenetic analysis that Chris did, it produced a much more robust analytical tree.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
We had to generate a lot of the data because it's just not available, which is one of the handicaps for doing a study like this.
Mm-hmm. So then dinosaurs do taste like chicken more than...
You know, I'm not really... I'm not that willing to try it out myself any more than to eat a mushroom made out of feces recycled. So.
There are people who have challenged you. In today's Washington Post, Pavel Pevsner of the University of California, San Diego, is quoted as saying that the findings are, quote, a joke.
Yes, I'm well aware of his problems with our analyses. And I guess what I would have to say, and this has to go with a fundamental practice of all sciences in general, is that, you know, in order for science to advance, you make some observations, you put out a hypothesis that explains those observations, and then you test that hypothesis by gathering data. That's exactly what we did. We made observations that our dinosaurs had soft tissue remains preserved in them. We put out the hypothesis that those soft tissues represented some component of the animal while it was alive that was produced by the animal cells. And we used multiple methods. We used in situ antibody binding. We used Western blots. We used atomic force microscopy. We used multiple methods to demonstrate that these proteins were indeed coming from the dinosaur itself. The mass spec was one of those analytical lines, but we had all this data that supported our hypothesis. Now, you might not like our hypothesis, our data, our interpretations, but that is no reason to make fun of our results and our analysis by saying that our paper is a joke. To be scientifically professional, what he would do would be to come up with an alternative hypothesis that explains our data. And then he would produce more data that would explain and support his hypothesis over ours. And that has not been done to anything that I've seen published. Mm. So at this point in time, I think the data is fairly strong on our side. And yes, it is completely controversial. It is not expected, but you don't argue it by saying you don't like it. Mm-hmm. You argue it with data.
1-800-989-8255. Mark in Grand Rapids. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Turn your radio down, please. Mark, are you there? I guess we're done with Mark. Let's go to Brandon in Oklahoma City. Hi, Brandon. Brandon, hey, are you there? Hi there.
Hey, yeah, I was just wanting to say I don't think it's a joke. I absolutely like your data and your hypothesis and your interpretation of that data. I was wondering if you think this at all might have any kind of effect on the whole evolution versus creation debate.
Oh, my.
Yeah, I know.
I'm
sorry, I didn't mean to go into it that big, but yeah, I just wanted to ask that.
Well, of course, what we've been asked a lot is, you know, of course, everyone knows things can't persist this long, therefore, you know, the dinosaurs have got to be younger than we think. And my answer to that is that, well, I actually have several answers, but the one I'll give on the radio here is that we've been studying how to interpret dating and timing of the Earth for 300 years. We basically learned the structure and function of DNA back in the late 50s and early 60s. So I think it's far more realistic to suppose that our understanding of molecular degradation patterns is flawed than our interpretations of the age of the Earth. I think I don't think that this has any bearing at all on the creation versus evolution debate.
Mm-hmm.
At least it doesn't in my mind. What we've done is we've shown that proteins persist longer than we thought they could.
The other really interesting focus of that of the paper was on mastodon proteins, showing a relationship between them and modern-day elephants. I thought
yes.
That was fascinating, too.
It is, and it actually is. We include the mastodon in this study because it's a proof of concept.
Did you just throw that in there for a little bonus?
No, what we did was say, look, we can do this. It's consistent. We've been able to do it on animals that are between 300 and 600,000 years old. And what we also showed is that there's a lot of protein in those bones. And so this is, like I said, it's proof of concept. By taking the mass spec sequences of the mastodon bone that's 300,000 years old and using the same procedure on that, we've been able to demonstrate that our methodologies work and they're accurate. And then we can say, okay, they work and they're accurate for 300,000-year-old bone. We use the same methods on 68-million-year-old bone, and we're getting results that follow what you'd predict. Far, far less protein than we see in a 300,000-year-old specimen, but the methodologies are equally as good.
With new confidence in this methodology, do you suggest people go look back at their fossils for other evidence of that might be still there that they thought, well, nothing could survive this long?
Well, I think that's a really important thing to consider is how over the course of scientific history, our assumptions have dictated our science in that if the reigning conventional wisdom states there's nothing there, you're not going to look, and you guaranteed will not find anything if you don't look. That was basically the state of our science until you know, we kind of looked by accident and found things that weren't supposed to be there. So should they go back and start dissolving away dinosaurs from the museum? No, I don't think so, because another part of our data, and realize that this paper that came out yesterday is just one part of our ongoing research, but part of our data shows that that when you remove fossils from an environment to which they've equilibrated over the course of billions or millions of years, the degradation process starts up again. So we've taken this nice cocooned piece of dinosaur bone and we've exposed it to Raleigh temperatures and humidity. We've exposed it to fluctuations in light and dark. We've exposed it to temperature fluctuations. As much as we try to control it, it certainly happens. Modern fungal invasions, whatever, that you simply can't predict under the conditions that we have. And so, you know, everything happens the same also when you put a fossil on display in the museum. You've got people walking by, breathing on and contaminating it. And so I think their best bet is to go from this point forward when they go out in the field this summer and begin to do their dinosaur excavations to reserve part of the bones that they find for this type of analysis and get the analysis done immediately.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow with Mary Higby Schweitzer, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Ray in Virginia. Hi, Ray.
Hi, everyone. Well, is this alligator bird warm or cold-blooded?
Nice, very good question, but our data doesn't speak to that. I have opinions, but we can't show this with a few protein collagen sequences from the dinosaur. There is not that kind of information.
What's your opinion on this?
My opinion is that if you begin as a cold-blooded organism like all vertebrate taxa did, and you want to become a warm-blooded organism, it's not going to happen overnight. And so it's my personal opinion that these dinosaurs were probably at a elevated metabolic rate, more than what you'd see in modern crocodiles, but probably not the metabolic rate that you see in modern birds like a hummingbird. I think they were certainly more on the warm-blooded side of things than the cold-blooded side of things. But were they functionally completely warm-blooded? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Stan in Tallahassee, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, I had a question. I just picked up the radio recently, but did you find any DNA in the bones, or was it just collagen, or...
I personally did not look for DNA. My lab is not set up to work with ancient DNA, which I'm sure you can appreciate is an extremely difficult, challenging, and restrictive environment. I do work with colleagues that do more of that than I do, and when we're ready, we will probably give it an attempt or try to optimize our chances of recovering it. But at this point in time, I haven't looked.
Tell us, since it's been about a year since we talked about this, tell us about what the sample was, where it was found, and why. Do you think there were special circumstances that preserved the collagen?
Yes and no. This dinosaur was buried under a huge cemented sandstone cliff, and we have evidence by looking at the surrounding sediments that it was buried rather quickly and essentially closed off from a lot of environmental contamination and environmental processes that degrade an organism. For some reason, in a lot of the other studies we've done, sandstone seems to be a mitigating factor, and I'm not sure why. I have some ideas, but I think the sandstone environment, the deep, relatively rapid burial had a lot to do with it, and then again, equilibration with the environment where you're not exposing it to a lot of things that degrade bone. Other work that's been done recently, such as a demineralization paper published by Herman Elrich, suggest that there are microenvironments within mineralized tissues like bone that favor the preservation of organics, and it's simply a matter of trying to figure out how to get them out.
Hmm. So as you say, your advice is to, as going forward now, is to set apart a little bit of that fossil.
Yes.
And on just about every dig. That doesn't have to be in that special circumstance that you described.
No, at this point in time, one of the really interesting research questions we can address is, why is this stuff preserved? And for that, we need to look at bones from different environments.
Mm-hmm.
And see if it really is an environmental factor.
Do you have people lining up now with bones for you?
Well, you know, there still is this inherent reticence of people wanting me to dissolve away their bones. In fact, usually I'm barred from, you know, storage and collection. But, we have had a lot of colleagues express interest. I've given several talks on how to do this better. But in reality, the thing that my colleagues could do to help move this field forward or to help me the most is to do a similar study on a different specimen completely independent from me. Mm-hmm. That's going to add to the strength of what we're trying to do, not take away from it, and I would facilitate it in any way that I can. But until people start making a conscious effort to replicate our work, it's always going to be viewed with some kind of suspicion.
Are people doing that, or are they just saying, that's your work, we're not going to go there?
Well, the problem is that most of the people who study dinosaurs are trained more classically, and they kind of do dinosaurs because they hate chemistry and standing in a lab and playing with solutions, which is extremely understandable because it's kind of boring. So I think that those people who who could do this kind of work and who have the skills to do it are busy trying to come up with treatments for cancer.
Bring a chemist along with you.
Hey, we're trying. Believe me, I keep arm-twisting my colleagues, and so far I haven't had any luck.
All right, well, maybe we've aired it, and people are listening, and we'll come to your rescue, Dr. Schweitzer.
Let's hope so.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Mary Higby
Schweitzer,
you're welcome, Associate Professor of Marine, Earth, and Atmospheric Sciences at NC State University and Associate Curator of Paleontology at North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. Our program is produced by Karen Vergoth, Molly Webster, and Senior Producer Ned Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our producer for digital media. Schumann Ma, our Metcalf Fellow. Josh Rogerson, our technical director, and here at the Con in New York. The Teen Grid broadcast is organized by Kelly Jarnack at the Public Library of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. Stephanie Smith with NASA Learning Technologies. You're welcome to write us the classic way, Science Friday, for West 43rd Street, room 306, New York, New York, 10036. Check out our podcasts and our blogging and our videos at sciencefriday.com. Some new interesting videos up this week. And we're interested in your videos if you have them. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.